If either turns out to be a C student, I will gently but emphatically advise them to find a full-time job right after high school. Finally, none of my maxims assumes human beings base their educational decisions on careful calculations of the return to education. Quite the opposite. If human beings based their educational decisions on careful calculations of the return to education, they wouldn't need my advice because they'd already be following it. My assumption, rather, is that our educational decisions are deeply corrupted by inexperience, conformity, and pride. My goal is to save listeners time, money, and grief by rooting out or at least curbing this corruption. Doubts. Thousands of papers calculate the selfish return to education. Why should we prefer my numbers to anyone else's? First, to the best of my knowledge, I am the only researcher to account for ability bias, sheepskin effects, and completion probability at the same time. All three forces are so mighty that ignoring even one discredits the answer. Second, to the best of my knowledge, my numbers are the most comprehensive. I investigate every semi-plausible benefit and cost of education, and my calculations incorporate whatever I find in the return. Third, I never retreat to agnosticism. I strive to compile the best available evidence from every relevant field. Yet when the best evidence is mixed or weak, I explicitly state my best guess and run with it. My refusal to meet uncertainty with reticence may horrify fellow academics. The real world, however, denies us the luxury of waiting for certainty. If researchers withhold our best guesses from students, students have to act on their own best guesses, corrupted as they are by inexperience, conformity, and pride. Still, I'm enough of an academic to crave penance for building on imperfect evidence. To ease my intellectual conscience, I now confess my greatest doubts about my efforts. Completion probabilities. Probabilities are definitely low, especially for weaker students, but the evidence is surprisingly thin. I end up relying on one model for high school and one for the bachelor's. I wish I had 10 canonical models of completion probability for each educational level, but to the best of my knowledge, they aren't accessible. How school and work feel. There isn't enough research on how students emotionally experience school versus work. Most adults have done both for years, but few researchers seriously compare the two. The same goes for job satisfaction. Education and health. Research on the health effects of education is sprawling. My concern, their numbers look small to me, even though many health economists call their effects big. The disparity could be driven by the dollar values I pin on health outcomes. If you think people value a year of life at more than double their yearly full-time income, or if you think people in good health would give up more than 20% of their total full-time income to have excellent health, education's return is understated. The neglected master's. Evidence on the master's degree is sparse. Estimates of the sheepskin effect are scarce and vary widely, so I stipulate that the master's sheepskin breakdown matches the bachelor's. Completion rates for the master's are lower than the bachelor's, but I failed to locate any statistical models that estimate how master's completion varies by prior academic performance. While broad outlines are not in doubt, I also located no solid evidence on how, correcting for student ability, the master's payoff varies by discipline. Sins of omission. To keep my write-up manageable, I gloss over three major credentials: the associate degree, the professional degree, and the PhD. My assessments, however, are no surprise. The associate completion probability is abysmal. The degree officially takes 2 years, but the 6-year graduation rate for exclusively full-time students is only 58%. And even if you finish, the labor market only modestly rewards the associate credential, with the important exception of vocational programs like nursing. The professional degree and the PhD, in contrast, pay well for most disciplines. Unfortunately, the vast majority of students lack the ability to survive these programs. Most PhD students have spent their entire lives at the top of the class, yet half wander off before they defend their dissertations. Professional completion rates tend to be higher. For example, over 80% of medical students finish their degrees on time. To maintain such numbers, however, professional schools rely on brutal admission standards. They don't even give the average college grad the chance to flunk. Quantification fosters illusions of certainty and precision. I disclaim both. My estimates of the selfish return to education are educated guesswork, nothing more. The crucial fact to remember, no important decision can be based on anything better than educated guesswork. The question is not whether you should rely on educated guesswork, but whether you should rely on mine. I obviously think you should. If you demur, check out my competitors and note all they ignore. The spreadsheet of you. Your career hinges on your educational path. Wherever you turn, you're betting years of your life and often tens of thousands of dollars. As a decision maker, you're perfectly free to follow your gut or follow the herd. Yet given the prevalence of subprime educational investments, you shouldn't trust either. Audit your gut. Audit the herd. Crunch the numbers until you have numbers to live by. True, prudence and dollars are not the same, but the prudent course is to assign dollar values to everything you care about and maximize the dollar value of that. Do you like term papers, art history, or strolling Princeton's idyllic grounds? Do you hate lectures, sitting still, or failure? Great. Put dollar values on each and every facet you care about. Give your future a few hours of undivided attention. Personalize my spreadsheets until they fit you like a glove, then compare your options. No matter how long you scrutinize these spreadsheets, remember, you're calculating education's selfish return. Irreproachable numbers won't resolve whether your education enriches mankind. To calculate education's social return, you have to rethink every number. You have to drop questions like, how much does my schooling cost me, in favor of questions like, how much does my schooling cost society? Above all, you must remember the power of signaling. My estimates of the selfish return to education are only moderately pessimistic. Taking signaling seriously moves us from this moderate pessimism to my admittedly radical case against education. Chapter 6. We care if it's signaling. The social return to education. The selfish rate of return concisely values personal investments. How fruitful were your sacrifice of time and money? For some purposes, this amoralism is defensible. I wouldn't trust an academic advisor who harangued my children about what's best for society. Talk about what's best for my child, or don't talk at all. Yet for other purposes, looking out for number one is a lousy guide. As a college professor, I would immensely profit if federal, state, and local governments launched a war on ignorance by tripling their spending on higher education. But enriching Brian Kaplan is a terrible argument for a war on ignorance. To persuasively evaluate each crusade, we have to count everyone's interests, not mine alone. Counting everyone's interests sounds like a green light for holistic thinking, but it's not. Broad social concern is a reason to carefully rework our calculations, not throw away our calculator. To measure the selfish rate of return, we put dollar values on everything one student cares about. To measure an analogous social rate of return, we put dollar values on everything anyone cares about. Signaling barely made a peep last chapter. The omission was intentional. Selfishly speaking, the critical question is, how well will my education pay, not why will my education pay? In this chapter, signaling brashly returns. Remember, once employers know enough to rank job candidates, further signaling is pure redistribution. When you calculate education's selfish return, you can ignore this truism. Money's money, even if it ultimately comes out of others' paychecks. From a social point of view, however, redistribution is sterile. When you calculate education's social return, you should presume signaling's payoff is illusory, because, socially speaking, it normally is. The social return to education, a primer. Calculating education's selfish return was challenging. Calculating its social return is daunting. In practice, most economists take the easy way out. They start with the selfish return, tweak it in two simple ways, then call it a day. Why start with the selfish return? Because most economists tacitly embrace human capital purism. If your education raises your income by $1,000, your education made you $1,000 more productive. What about signaling? Meh, that's only a theory. Still, even human capital purists recognize social and selfish returns diverge. Students don't pay the full cost of their education. Taxpayers fully subsidize public K-12, heavily subsidize public colleges, and partially subsidize private colleges. Neither do workers receive the full benefit of their education. When education helps you in the labor market, your taxes go up, and your government's transfers, such as unemployment insurance, go down. To handle these wrinkles, researchers routinely A, count taxpayers' support as a social cost of education, and B, count workers' full market compensation as a social benefit of education. These adjustments are steps in the right direction, but if you seek serious estimates of education's social return, they are woefully insufficient. We didn't take shortcuts to education's selfish return, and we won't take them to its social return. Instead, we'll go back to square one, brainstorming, then investigating education's every semi-plausible benefit and cost. The social return to education, recounting everything that counts. Fortunately, half our brainstorming is already done. Last chapter inventoried education's alleged private benefits and costs, so we can skip to their investigation phase. How, item by item, do social and private effects diverge? To take an obvious case, education has a hefty marital return. Socially speaking, however, this is zero sum. Your degree helps you hook a rich spouse, but if you hadn't earned your degree, your rich spouse would have married and enriched someone else instead. By this logic, social returns should omit education's marital payoff. But rethinking education's private effects from a social perspective isn't enough. When figuring education's selfish return, many conceivable benefits never come up because, genuine or not, they're purely social. If education reduces violent crime, it's not the student who benefits, it's everyone they would have victimized, not to mention taxpayers who fund police, courts, and prisons. To extract education's social return, then, we must also brainstorm for purely social effects, then examine each in turn. From compensation to productivity. The selfish return to education hinges on compensation. How much pay do you forfeit while you're in school, and how much extra pay do you capture after you finish? The social return to education, in contrast, hinges on productivity. How much stuff does society forfeit while you're in school, and how much extra stuff does society capture after you finish? In a pure human capital story, compensation and productivity are equal case by case. Employers won't want you if you ask more than you produce and can't get you if they offer less than you produce. In a pure signaling model, in contrast, compensation and production are equal only on average. When your credentials match your ability, your productivity matches your pay. Otherwise, pay and productivity diverge. If your credentials are unusually weak for someone of your ability, you earn less than you produce. If your credentials are unusually strong for someone of your ability, you earn more than you produce. To calculate education's social return, then, you must know why education raises pay and benefits. If education boosts compensation solely by raising worker productivity, society's gain equals the worker's gain. If education boosts compensation solely by revealing worker productivity, society gains far less. For most purposes, in fact, society gains zero. True, the economy is more productive and society richer when employers know which workers are good and which workers aren't. Knowledge is wealth. So ranking students has social value. But once students have been properly ranked, the social value ends. Employers' knowledge of worker quality would be essentially identical if everyone had one less degree, right? In economic jargon, the marginal social benefit of signaling is roughly zero even though its total social benefit is substantial. Precisely what share of education's effects on earnings and employment stems from signaling? Evidence reviewed in earlier chapters leads to a cautious and a reasonable view of signaling's role. The cautious view hands signaling full credit for the sheepskin effect, but no more. Given our sheepskin breakdowns, this implies signaling shares of 38% for high school, 59% for the bachelor's, and 74% for the master's. More plausibly, though, part of the ordinary year-to-year return is signaling as well. An extra year of education may not say a lot about you, but it says something. How much? Multiple approaches point to a reasonable estimate of 80% signaling overall. If the sheepskin effect is all signaling, this implies a year-to-year signaling share of 57% for high school, 47% for the bachelor's, and 25% for the master's. When deriving education's effect on productivity, the driving assumption is that workers, on average, earn what they're worth. A good student with a BA earns what he produces because a good student, by definition, has the ability of an average worker with a BA. If the same student goes straight to work after high school, however, the market doesn't merely pay him less, it pays him less than he produces. Why? Because his credentials make him look worse than he really is. If the good student gets an MA, similarly, the market doesn't merely pay him more, it pays him more than he produces. Why? Because his credentials make him look better than he really is. As signaling's share ascends, so do the spreads between productivity and pay. From a selfish point of view, the pay you miss while you're in school and the raise you get once you're out of school are symmetric. The pay you miss is all selfish cost. The raise you get is all selfish benefit. From a social point of view, however, what counts is productivity, not pay. The social cost of school is the stuff you fail to produce. The social benefit of school is the extra stuff you learn to produce. If education's payoff is 80% signaling, and a year of education raises annual earnings by $5,000, only $1,000 is a true gain to society. The other $4,000 is your reward for convincing employers they've been underestimating your value. Employment. Suppose 4 years of college cut your unemployment risk from 9% to 4%. If education's rewards are 80% signaling, this means 20% of college grads' reduced risk of unemployment, one percentage point, stems from their enhanced productivity. The rest is zero sum. Your college degree lowers your unemployment risk by raising the risk for your unadorned rivals. Taxes and transfers. As extra education advances your career, government takes more of your money and gives you less of its help. Yet from a social point of view, such modifications are zero sum. If your education boosts your productivity $1,000, society is $1,000 richer, even if you keep only $500 after taxes. If your education prompts the government to cut your welfare payment $1,000, society is no poorer, even though you're $1,000 in the hole. In one way, then, social returns are more straightforward than private returns. The Byzantine tax code and patchwork welfare state are distractions from what counts. Production. Job satisfaction, happiness, and the joy of learning. Though the better educated have greater job satisfaction and happiness, the reason is largely material. The educated enjoy their jobs and lives more because they make more money, not because their careers feel more fulfilling. Does education have any independent impact on job satisfaction or happiness? While some researchers detect mild benefits, others discover that, money aside, the well-educated feel worse about their lives. If you drive a cab for a living, a college diploma makes you see a failure in the rearview mirror. From a social point of view, education's effect on job satisfaction and happiness is even more questionable. Humans savor status, a high rank in the pecking order. In our society, status heavily depends on education. Unfortunately, status is, almost by definition, zero sum. As society's education rises, so does the education one needs to feel socially superior. The disturbing implication? Even if education were a path to personal happiness, it could remain a dead end for social happiness. Research on this sphere is sparse but intriguing. In the general social survey, education slightly lifts individuals' job satisfaction and happiness, even if income stays the same. How? By pushing them up the hierarchy. Correcting for status, education's effect on job satisfaction vanishes, and its effect on happiness shrinks by two-thirds. If there's little reason to think education makes one human happier with their job or life, there's even less reason to think education makes humanity happier with its jobs or lives. Since my selfish returns already set education's effect on job satisfaction and happiness to zero, my social returns do the same. What about the classroom experience? On average, as last chapter reported, school is one of people's least liked activities. They're not fond of work either, but resent school slightly more. From a social point of view, there is every reason to take their feelings at face value. If your teacher bores you to death, the knowledge that millions of other kids are equally bored is scant consolation. Health. Health researchers normally treat education like hygiene. Everyone will be healthier if everyone passes their exams, just as everyone will be healthier if everyone washes their hands. Still, scholars intermittently wonder if the effect of education on health is a covert effect of status on health. Animal experiments confirm status does a body good. Altering an animal's rank in the pecking order shifts its health in the same direction. Human health could work the same way. Selfishly speaking, this is idle curiosity. As long as education invigorates you, who cares about the mechanism? Socially speaking, however, the interplay between education, status, and health is all important. Insofar as schooling makes you healthier by raising your status, its health benefits are zero-sum. You can't raise your rank without dragging others down, so you can't make yourself well without making others sick. When researchers check, they consistently verify that human health and status go hand in hand. Furthermore, education's health benefits are, at least in part, status benefits in disguise. Correcting for status, anywhere from 20% to 60% of education's apparent effect on self-reported health vanishes. On the General Social Survey's 4-point health scale, correcting for status halves my earlier estimate of education's health benefit from 0.04 per year to 0.02 per year. Last chapter named multiple reasons to think education's true health benefit is even smaller than it looks. From a social standpoint, the status evidence calls for one last downgrade. Since the selfish health benefit is small and the status effect is substantial, I mark education's social health benefits down to zero. Academic achievement is unlike hygiene. If everyone had a BA or more, people who had only BAs would stand on the lowest rung of the social ladder, with health woes to match. Tuition and other expenses. Selfishly speaking, the standout cost of education is foregone earnings, not tuition or other student fees. Public high school remains free of charge. Although public college's average list price now exceeds $9,000, their typical student pays under $4,000, thanks to a smorgasbord of discounts and subsidies. But socially speaking, the relevant number is not cost to the student, but cost to everyone, especially public education's forgotten man, the taxpayer. Start with the full cost of public K through 12. The per-student bill varies massively from state to state. In 2009-2010, the latest available year, Utah spent $7,916. Washington, D.C. tripled that for a grand total of $23,816. The U.S. average was $12,136. This figure is all-inclusive, counting cost of instruction, support services, food, enterprise operations, capital outlays, and interest payments. When calculating the social cost of the typical high school student's education, however, this number isn't quite right. The big glitch? Official figures include special education, and special education is expensive. Schools now classify about 13% of their students as disabled. And standard estimates say special education is twice as costly as regular education. Taking official statistics at face value, the social cost of educating students who aren't disabled is only 88% of the average. Yet common sense balks at the idea that 13% of U.S. students are meaningfully disabled. Critics back up this common-sense skepticism, arguing schools have strong incentives to inflate their disability numbers. If we subtract out the most elastic special education category, specific learning disability, the disabled fraction falls to a more creditable 8.2%. Using this toned-down figure implies the typical high school student costs 92% of the average, for a total of $11,165. A smaller glitch, the social cost of K-12 should exclude food, for the same reason the selfish cost of college excludes room and board. Kids eat whether or not they're in school. Subtracting food costs, per student social cost falls another $405 to $10,760, or $11,298 in 2011 dollars. Calculating the full social cost of college has its own complications. Using list price is tempting but misguided. College's standard financial strategy is to combine an exorbitant list price with ample discounts. While schools frame this discounting as high-minded do-gooding, it amounts to what economists call price discrimination, tailoring prices to squeeze extra profits out of richer and less flexible customers. Price discrimination is the standard story about why travelers pay vastly more for same-day plane tickets. List tuition does not capture the true cost of schooling any more than same-day plane fare captures the true cost of flying. From this vantage point, there is a fundamental divide between institutional grants, tuition breaks offered by schools themselves, and federal, state, private, and employer grants. Institutional grants don't really burn social resources. Schools offer them precisely because education costs less than list price to provide. Federal, state, private, and employer grants, in contrast, burn social resources by making students unable or unwilling to defray the cost of their own education profitable to admit. To measure the full social cost of college, then, I start with list price, then subtract average institutional grants. The College Board, again, provides all the relevant figures. Public four-year colleges offer $1,133 in institutional grants per student. Since list price is $9,412, this implies a social cost of $8,279. Financial data on master's programs is sparse, so I continue to equate the cost of graduate and undergraduate education. If anything, this is optimistic, because small graduate classes imply high per-student costs. Accounting for experience. A trained worker returns to school reluctantly. The more experience they have, the more money they make. The more money they make, the more they sacrifice on hiatus. Socially, the story is the same. The more experience a worker has, the more they produce. The more they produce, the more society sacrifices when the worker takes time off. My social return numbers therefore stick with last chapter's 2.5% annual experience premium. Completion probability. Social investments, like private investments, always risk failure. A percentage point of risk slices 1% off expected benefits. Suppose an investment, if successful, yields $1,000 of selfish benefits and $200 of social benefits. Given a 20% risk of abject failure, expected selfish benefits fall to $800, and expected social benefits fall to $160. Last chapter already estimated completion probabilities. Social returns must continue to factor them in. What if a government program shears the risk of educational failure? All else equal, selfish and social returns rise. But all else equal is key. The cheapest and surest way to raise high school graduation rates is indiscriminately awarding diplomas to all. Before long, however, this infinitely merciful system erases the selfish and social gains of graduation. If everyone gets a diploma, no one does. Chapter 7 ponders constructive ways to boost completion probabilities. For now, the goal is evaluating education as it really is, not education as it might be. The social return to education, purely social benefits. Economists' educational bean counting can come off as annoyingly narrow. Normal human beings, also known as non-economists, lean holistic, We can't measure education's social benefits by tweaking its selfish benefits. Instead, we must ask ourselves, what kind of society do we want to live in? An educated society or an ignorant one? Normal human beings score a solid point. We can and should investigate education's broad social implications. But that is a poor excuse for discarding what we already know. Evidence on education's broad social effects should supplement, not supplant, evidence on its narrow effects. In any case, looking at the big picture is no excuse for innumeracy. If education curtails murder, that is a point in its favor. But it's a lame point until you ballpark A, how much extra education costs, and B, how many murders it prevents. Instead of scorning bean counters, we should scrupulously count beans of every description. Economic growth. New ideas are the root of progress. People today live far longer than they did in 1800 because people today know far more than they did in 1800. Earth in 1800 contained all the materials required to make an airplane or an iPad, but until the right ideas came along, the materials lay fallow. Why did mankind have to wait so long for the right ideas to arrive? Part of the answer is that ideas, once created, are cheap to copy. As a result, innovators glean only a sliver of the value they create. These truisms lead straight to the stirring sermon, Education, Foundation of a Dynamic Society. While most students are not creative, heavy K-12 investment fertilizes society's creative potential by giving everyone the mental tools to innovate. Heavy investment in colleges and universities, similarly, brings top students up to the research frontier and provides innovation leaders with employment and funding. If consistently investing 10% of national income in education elevates the annual growth rate from 1% to 2% without any further benefits, the social return is a hefty 11%. Unfortunately, this stirring sermon is wishful thinking. Chapter 4 already reviewed research on the national education premium. While the evidence is messy, education seemingly does less for countries than individuals. At the national level, it's not clear that education increases living standards at all, much less that education makes countries' living standards increase at a faster rate. If you can't tell if your machine moves, you may safely assume it's not a perpetual motion machine. Researchers who specifically test whether education accelerates progress have little to show for their efforts. One could reply that given all the flaws of long-run macroeconomic data, we should ignore academic research in favor of common sense. But what does common sense really say? An educated people is an innovative people sounds plausible. Until you recall the otherworldliness of the curriculum. In high school, students spend only about a quarter of their time on math and science. In college, about 5% of students major in engineering, 2% in computer science, and 5% in biology and biomedical science. Giving students the mental tools they need to innovate is, at best, an afterthought. In the modern world, moreover, the brightest minds often end up as university professors, applying their creativity to topics of academic interest rather than commercial value. True, ivory tower self-indulgence occasionally revolutionizes an industry. Yet common sense insists the best way to discover useful ideas is to search for useful ideas, not to search for whatever fascinates you and pray it turns out to be useful. Workforce participation. As education rises, so does workforce participation, the likelihood of wanting a job. In other words, as education goes up, voluntary unemployment goes down. This partly reflects ability bias. Some people are stayers, unwilling to abandon their commitments. Others are quitters, who walk away when the going gets tough. Still, there is every reason to think education's apparent effect is partly genuine. Extra education reinforces the desire to work. Selfishly speaking, this is no cause for celebration. What's so great about changing your own priorities? Suppose education caused us to spend less time with our families and more time working. It's unclear why this shift would count in education's favor. Socially speaking, however, the welfare state makes even voluntary unemployment a burden to others. Idlers get more than they produce via programs like Medicaid and food stamps. Workers get less than they produce owing to levies like income and payroll taxes. This doesn't mean it's best for society to make everyone work. Stay-at-home parents, retirees, and slackers are part of society after all. The point is that extra workforce participation can simultaneously be a bad deal for the individual and a good deal for humanity. When education boosts workforce participation, social returns have to count what individuals selfishly ignore. All the taxes they start paying and all the transfers they stop collecting. Intuitively, suppose the government gives you $10,000 a year while you're out of the labor force. If you worked, your pre-tax productivity would be $30,000, but you'd pay $5,000 in taxes and forfeit your $10,000 in transfers. If you care only about yourself, you'll work if you value your time less than $15,000. If you care about everyone, you'll work if you value your time less than $30,000. Tallying taxes is straightforward, but transfers are messy. As long as workers are full-time and childless, even those with eighth-grade educations normally earn too much to collect anything beyond unemployment insurance. Once workers exit the job market, however, their labor earnings fall to zero. Most instantly become eligible for government programs we've hitherto managed to ignore. The big transfer programs are Medicaid, TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families or Welfare, and SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program or food stamps. Since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, a single childless adult with zero income can definitely get Medicaid. Valued at cost, this is worth $4,362 a year. TANF is limited to households with kids, so single childless adults cannot collect. SNAP's rules are complex. Childless adults face time limits or work requirements, but state governments can make exceptions. In 2011, an eligible single adult with zero income collected roughly $2,192 in food stamps. My social return calculations assign the sum of these Medicaid and SNAP payments to anyone out of the labor force. Signaling, as usual, is the final wrinkle. Give an individual more education and they get better offers, so they're more likely to want a job. Give everyone more education and you ignite credential inflation. Implausible? Ponder this. In 1950, only 33% of adult males had finished high school. But male workforce participation was higher than today. Crime. About 65% of American inmates never earned standard high school diplomas. In 2006-2007, 8.7% of male dropouts aged 16 to 24 were incarcerated. Around 15% of white male dropouts and 70% of black male dropouts spend some time in prison by their mid-30s. All these rates are roughly two-thirds lower for men who finished high school and minuscule for college graduates. Dwelling on such vast disparities raises high hopes. Maybe society can prevent crime with school instead of punishing crime with prison. Don't the numbers imply universal high school graduation would eradicate half of all crime? Hardly. As usual, there is less to education than meets the eye. Dropouts' troubles emerge long before they quit school. They don't just have low IQs and poor grades, they're precocious troublemakers. Future dropouts are much more likely to be suspended from school and get arrested. They smoke more, drink more, use more drugs, and have more sex, and start their risky habits younger. Before crediting education for observed crime differences, then, you must count for ability bias in all its forms. Instead of asking, how law-abiding are dropouts compared to high school grads, you should ask, how law-abiding are dropouts compared to high school grads with identical IQs, grades, personalities, and juvenile behavior? Correcting for IQ and grades makes education look only mildly less effective at preventing crime. The game changer is the criminal personality. Future criminals, like future dropouts, are impulsive, aggressive, and defiant, and act accordingly. Their illegal careers usually start when they're still in school. When researchers correct for early antisocial attitudes and behavior, the measured effect of education on crime plummets. In naive estimates, an extra year of education reduces expected lifetime jail time by about 4 weeks, and the probability of serving any time by about 2 percentage points. But correcting for demographics, intelligence, class rank, personality, and early deviance, an extra year of education cuts expected lifetime jail time by less than 1 week, and the probability of serving any time by about 0.5 percentage point. Yet even such vestigial effects may be of great social value because the all-inclusive social cost of crime is titanic. The current budgetary cost of imprisoning a criminal is about $30,000 a year, but crimes committed vastly outnumber sentences served. Murder aside, offenses rarely lead to arrest, much less prison. Only 3-5% of rapes, robberies, and aggravated assaults, and less than 1% of property crimes, lead to jail time. Yet for each and every violent and property crime, at least one victim suffers, often horribly. Everyone who takes costly precautions to avoid victimization shoulders an additional burden. Setting aside victimless crimes, the most comprehensive tally of crime's social cost comes out to $3,728 per American per year in 2011 dollars. The total cost of the crime members of society suffer must equal the total cost of the crime members of society inflict. As long as criminality is proportional to incarceration, then, we can compute yearly average crime costs by education. Raw gaps are so huge that social benefits remain sizable after subtracting 75% ability bias. Yet, there's a subtler reason to dial down estimates of the pacifying power of education. Signaling. If signaling is potent, education can defuse individual criminality with little impact on society's criminality. The mechanism should be painfully familiar. Hand one delinquent a high school diploma and they look better to employers. Hand every delinquent a high school diploma, however, and the credential loses all worth. It no longer boosts legal income and therefore leaves crime as attractive as ever. Think that's a stretch? Back in 1950, when adult male dropouts outnumbered high school grads 2-1, the U.S. murder rate was no higher than today. Signaling's elegant explanation? Back in 1950, the average dropout stood at the 33rd percentile of achievement, so employer stigma against dropouts was mild. Today, the average dropout stands at the 10th percentile of achievement, so the employer stigma against dropouts is severe, making crime an appealing substitute for honest toil. Recall that sheepskin effects, oversized gains for crossing academic finish lines, are a telling symptom of signaling. If education truly instilled respect for law and order, there would be nothing special about graduation. In crime data, however, high school's senior year stands out like a sore thumb. According to the U.S. Census, men who quit high school are almost as likely to be jailed as men who finished only middle school. But when men pass the 12th grade finish line, their chance of incarceration crashes nearly 50%. Research on this criminal sheepskin effect is virtually non-existent, but extending published work yields a stark result. Correcting for ability bias in all its forms, only the senior year of high school cuts crime. Since this evidence is thin, I assume the sheepskin breakdown for crime matches the sheepskin breakdown for income. The last year of high school counts as much as 3.4 regular years, and the last year of higher degrees counts as much as 6.7 regular years. Final complication. Crime is a young person's game, so if education restrains crime, most of the restraint kicks in quickly. Since social returns place heavier weight on earlier payoffs, returns must take this front-loading into account. Cumming calculations handle this wrinkle by merging arrest statistics by age with the age breakdown of the population. Politics. Democratic participation rises with education. The well-educated are more likely to vote, more interested in politics, and more likely to join political groups. For the sake of argument, suppose education deserved full credit for the extra political engagement. The big question remains, does more participation make public policy better or worse? To answer that big question, unfortunately, you have to A, figure out the best public policies, then B, measure whether education increases voter support for these policies. No matter what your policy views happen to be, the social value of participation hinges on the quality of participation. Throughout this audiobook, I've stood against intellectual buck-passing. But trying to figure out the best public policies in the middle of an education audiobook would be a mad detour. There's no remotely plausible way to resolve such vast issues in a single audiobook. Chapter 9 analyzes education's effects on values, including political values. These effects are, as usual, smaller than they look, but small or big, I leave their evaluation to the listener. Think of the quality of the children. If you compare children of college graduates to children of high school dropouts, there's one glaring difference. Children of college graduates enjoy far more academic success. Take American adults born after 1950. Only 37% of children of two dropouts finished high school. A mere 2% earned a BA. In the same era, 98% of children of two college grads finished high school and 56% earned a BA. These academic success gaps eventually translate into financial, career, and marital success gaps. Education conceivably has torrential ripple effects. Unfortunately, no one can tell if the ripples are genuine without facing an ancient debate. Nature versus nurture, heredity versus upbringing. Children resemble their parents in every measurable way. Tall parents have tall kids. Successful parents have successful kids. Why? Successful parents might have successful kids because of the way they raise them. But there's a competing theory. Successful parents might have successful kids because of the genes they gave them. In a 100% nurture story, the ripple effects of success are as big as they look. If two high school sweethearts graduate, they transform their home into an incubator for achievement. In a 100% nature story, the ripple effects of success are illusory. If two high school sweethearts graduate, they'll live in a nicer neighborhood, but the genes they pass on remain unchanged. For most of intellectual history, the nature-nurture debate was stuck in a ditch. In typical families, kids are raised by their biological parents, so nature and nurture are hopelessly intertwined. A few decades ago, however, scientists started intently studying atypical families, especially families with adoptees or twins, to tow the science of nature and nurture back to the road. Researchers studied adoptees to isolate the power of upbringing. If you randomly assign children to biologically unrelated families, yet clear family resemblance emerges, the mechanism almost has to be nurture. Researchers studied identical and fraternal twins to isolate the power of genes. If identical twins are more similar than fraternal twins, the mechanism almost has to be nature. This approach, called behavioral genetics, consistently finds strong, pervasive effects of nature and weak, sporadic effects of nurture. In developed countries, nature doesn't merely dwarf nurture on physical traits like height, weight, and longevity. Nature also dwarfs nurture on psychosocial traits like intelligence, happiness, personality, education, and income. The genes your parents give you at conception have a much larger effect on your success than all the advantages your parents gave you after conception. Behavioral geneticists have isolated the effects of upbringing on years of education, grades, and income. Both adoption and twin studies typically find that being raised by an adoptive parent with an extra year of education boosts your education by about 5 weeks. In other words, each generational ripple shrinks by a factor of 10. Similar studies find zero effect of upbringing on grades. Scholastic performance runs in families because performance hinges on students' talents, attitudes, and behavior, all of which revolve around genes. Adoption and twin studies also surprisingly find upbringing has an even tinier effect on income than education. Growing up in a family with 10% higher income raises your adult income by somewhere between 0 and 1%. In light of all this evidence, a reasonable guess is that whatever raises your income by 10% will raise each of your children's income by 0.5%, with near-zero effect on later descendants. And there's a catch. The labor market won't reward your children for your efforts until they actually start working. Nowadays, this means a multi-decade delay. So the ripples have a microscopic effect on education's social rate of return. My calculations round it down to zero. Think of the quantity of the children. Family size goes down as education goes up. Demographers often measure completed fertility, the total number of children women have by the time they're 40. In 2012, women who dropped out of high school had almost 50% more kids than women who finished college. Only 12% of dropouts were childless versus 21% of college grads. For the sake of argument, suppose education is the sole cause of these fertility gaps. The question remains, is thinning society's membership a social benefit or a social cost? This is no technocratic issue. You can't begin to answer without taking sides on a litany of controversies. Conventional thinkers emphasize the environmental dangers of higher population, but critics highlight offsetting economic advantages, especially for innovation. New ideas are the engine of economic growth, and ideas come from people. Picture a world where half your favorite writers, musicians, scientists, and entrepreneurs had never lived. Critics of population also often complain about crowding. But if crowding is so awful, why are urban rents so high? Because crowding has glorious side effects like opportunity, choice, and excitement. Even the birth of a clear-cut drain on society can be a net social benefit if, like most of us, the drain is glad to be alive. I raise these issues not to settle them, but to quarantine them. An audiobook on education is not the place to judge whether human beings are more trouble than they're worth. Chapter 9 narrows down education's true effect on family size. Yet the listener must judge if and when lower fertility is good, bad, or neutral. Crunching society's numbers, cautious signaling. We have reached another way station. After rethinking education's selfish effects in a socially minded way, we brainstormed and sifted the evidence on education's purely social effects. Now, on to our final destination, computing the social return to education for virtually anyone. As always, my underlying spreadsheets are online so readers can check the work and play with the assumptions. As expected, social returns hinge on the power of signaling. Remember, the higher signaling's share, the lower education's social return. As you near the pure signaling pole, the social return to education falls to zero, then goes negative. For clarity, let's begin with the relatively pro-education cautious signaling assumption. Remember, according to the cautious assumption, all benefits of education except sheepskin effects reflect human capital. The case of the good student revisited. Good students, by definition, have the raw ability of the typical BA. We've already scrutinized their selfish return to education. How worthwhile is good students' education taking everyone's interests into account? Social returns differ from selfish returns in two striking ways. Unlike selfish returns, social returns within each degree program are nearly flat. Graduation years are unusually lucrative for students, but are not especially constructive for mankind. More importantly, social returns are way lower than selfish returns. Factoring in a modest role for signaling, social degree returns are less than half of selfish degree returns. The social return for high school is a so-so 3.4%. The social return for college is poor, less than 2%. The social return for the master's is a ruinous negative 4%. Low returns are the rule, even though education provides an array of benefits for society as a whole. All computations grant that education boosts worker productivity and workforce participation and cuts unemployment and crime. Why the low social return? Because of the meager value of the combined benefits. The world overflows with better ways to invest. The government could pour more money into roads, cancer research, policing, baby bonuses, or debt repayment, or it could let taxpayers keep more of their own money. Private investors are almost sure to beat 3.4% over the long haul. Social returns by ability. There's nothing especially awful about investing educational resources in good students. Under the cautious assumption, educational investments usually pay poorly regardless of student ability. The return to college ranges from poor to ruinous, and the return to the master's is negative across the board. Social returns, like selfish returns, usually rise with student ability. Higher ability students are more likely to complete whatever education they attempt and use whatever education they complete. The one stark exception, sending poor students to high school, is the best social investment of all, reaping a handsome 6.1%. Since poor students incline to crime, crime has massive social costs, and most offenders are young, mildly curbing poor students' criminality more than pays for itself. With cautious signaling, education is a markedly worse use of social resources than almost anyone pictures. Sending kids to high school is tolerably rewarding, but hardly a no-brainer. Sending kids to college when they're likely to succeed is a bad investment. Sending kids to college when they're likely to fail is an awful investment. Encouraging college graduates to continue on to the master's is folly. Crunching society's numbers, reasonable signaling. The trouble with the cautious signaling assumption, as argued earlier, is it's too cautious. Every year of education, not just graduation, signals something good. What happens to education's social return given what I dub the reasonable view, namely that signaling accounts for 80% of education's benefits? The results are beyond bleak. Social returns are very low for every level of academic difficulty and every level of student ability. Sending poor students to high school earns a wretched 0.2%. Every other educational investment yields a negative return. To repeat, this does not mean schools fail to improve their students. They do. What it means, rather, is that students typically die of old age long before society recoups the initial outlay of time and money. Schooling's numerous social benefits pale before its staggering social cost. How can social returns be so low when selfish returns are pretty decent? Because signaling is a redistributive game, serving you a larger piece of the pie without enlarging it. Asking, how can there be too much education if education is lucrative, is like asking, how can there be too much air pollution if cars are convenient? Crunching society's numbers. You call that reasonable? Your best guess about signaling's share likely varies from mine. Indeed, while I'm confident that signaling is high, my 80% reasonable estimate remains fluid. How sensitive are pessimistic results to the ubiquity of signaling? With only one-third signaling, high school is a good deal, college is pretty good, and the master's a waste. This doesn't sound too bad for education until you recall we're discussing strong students. When signaling's share hits 50%, high school still looks like a decent deal, college is so-so, and the master's is ruinous. As signaling's share moves to two-thirds, social returns for even excellent and good students crash. Despite its privileged place in our social mythology, high school as we know it turns out to be a poor use of social resources. For weak students, results are grimmer. With one-third signaling high school is good or great, but further education is dubious or worse. With half signaling, high school's social return remains tolerable for fair students and ample for poor students. Anything more, though, is a waste. Pushing on to two-thirds signaling wipes out remaining pockets of hope. Sending poor students to high school isn't a terrible idea, but the rewards are nothing to write home about. Thus, one need not accept 80% signaling as reasonable to be unfashionably pessimistic. By mainstream standards, even one-third signaling shames education. While almost everyone should try high school, college is a good deal only for excellent students and a disaster for fair and poor students. The master's, moreover, is a bad deal across the board. 50% signaling raises doubts about college for excellent students and undermines the social value of high school. High school's only clear social dividend is embarrassing, slightly curtailing poor students' shocking propensity for crime. By the time signaling hits two-thirds, the case against education is nearly complete. High school for poor students pays tolerably, but returns on every other level-ability combination range from poor to ruinous. Searching for social returns. Averages conceal a lot. Do any educational investments enrich society despite the power of signaling? Major, selectivity, attitude, and social returns. Parental wisdom distinguishes real majors that teach marketable job skills from Mickey Mouse majors that teach irrelevant fluff. As expected, workers